A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
So the fact we're recording remotely, I assume, means that we've all been washed out by the torrential downpours of the last 48 hours. We're like separated by rivers.
I saw a couple of puddles yesterday when I was walking my dog and I almost panicked.
There was real rain. It was a lot of rain.
Yeah, I am currently well south of DC, and there was like some serious rain and flooding over here. It was no joke.
This was the sort of weather where in my old neighborhood, we would come back and find like our understair area flooded and all our Amazon packages just floating in like a foot of water that we'd then have to like get a pool skimmer to pull out that we bought just for this purpose to pull out of the puddle of water and try and salvage. So, you know, it's a real thing. Parts of D is still a swamp. You know, the water level is never too far away here in Washington, D.C. So it catches up with us in circumstances like this.
There's an interesting Washington Post piece a few weeks ago mapping the floodplain. And oh. I think what it referred to as ghost rivers or zombie streams or something like that. It sounded cooler than it was. It was basically like areas that used to be streams but are not anymore because stuff was built on top of them. It wasn't, you know, a river of zombies or anything like that. But essentially...
Not yet.
Yeah, right. Just wait for it. But when it rains heavily, those are the areas that tend to flood. It was pretty interesting.
All right. I retract my making fun of DC and its inability to deal with not even quite severe weather.
Because
it sounds like
true.
If you do not live on Capitol Hill where I live, that perhaps the rain was a bit more serious than the couple of several inch puddles that I saw.
Yeah, Natalie, it's in the name. You're on a hill.
That's true.
Yeah, fair exactly. Enough. Exactly.
That's just good real estate buying, guys.
I did. I am in the upper hill half of my neighborhood. And I will say it's a big difference if you go downhill a little bit. It gets real flooded to the point that they've been like digging a giant underground tunnel for the last 3 years involving one of those giant ground borers, which is a very cool thing to watch. Especially if you have a 2-year-old and a 3-year-old walking by occasionally. So it appears to be kind of a problem, but we're dealing with it. DC, not good on the weather front, admittedly.
I'm excited about this tunnel news because as I'm hoping to talk about in object lessons, I'm newly obsessed with tunnels.
Tunnels are really in the news these days in ways that are weird, but
I would just really like to celebrate the fact that we just intellectualized the weather with references to the news and articles about underground architecture.
Yeah, mostly Quinta, but that's fine.
Well, thank God we have Quinta here.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to Rational Security. I am one of your regular co-hosts, Scott R. Anderson, here in the virtual studio with my other co-host, Quinta Jurassic.
Hello.
And standing in the stead of the dearly departed, may he always be remembered, Alan Rosenstein, we are thrilled to be joined once again by Lawfare's executive editor, Natalie Orpit. Natalie, thank you for joining us once again here on Rational Security.
Why, thank you. But I shall never, ever aspire to fill the great shoes of Alan Rosenstein.
I don't think anybody wants to get near his shoes, I suspect. He's a large man, does a lot of walking. It's dangerous. We didn't even make you put on your Alan beard and your Alan wig on this time. Instead, we're just letting Natalie not even try to fill Alan's shoes and roll in this podcast. Well, we're excited to have you on because we, of course, have had a number of developments in national security news these past few weeks, which we are going to get to. A lot happening in the courtrooms here in the United States, courtrooms abroad. Courtrooms perhaps coming down the pike. And for that reason, we are calling this the courtroom drama edition of Rational Security as we dig through some of the drama in these big, big cases that promise to change the trajectory of the 2024 election, perhaps in one case, of major armed conflict in another case. And we're thrilled to have you here to talk them over with us, Natalie. For our first topic, ergo omnes. South Africa has brought Israel to the International Court of Justice for actions relating to its military campaign in Gaza, based on a novel legal theory that alleges Israeli violations of the Genocide Convention and asserts standing by virtue of the universal obligation to prevent genocide. What practical impact is this litigation likely to have, and what does it mean as a precedent for the international community? Topic 2, certs in doom petition. The Supreme Court has officially taken up former President Trump's appeal of a Colorado Supreme Court decision disqualifying him from the 2024 ballot there on the grounds that he is ineligible to hold office. While some have welcomed the chance to nationalize Colorado's holding, others have warned that doing so could be a grave blow to popular democracy. How will the matter play out, and what does it mean for the 2024 election and after? And topic three, Void Austin. Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin spent several days in the hospital earlier this month without notifying the White House, leaving what some believe was a gaping hole at the highest level of the U.S. military chain of command. How big a problem was this actually? What steps should be taken in response? For our first topic, Quinta, let me hand it over to you to get us started.
So as you mentioned, Scott, South Africa has brought a case against Israel in the International Court of Justice, which we should clarify is different from the International Criminal Court, alleging breaches.
Finally, somebody says it in the mainstream media, no less ish. Anyway,
yeah, Rational Security counts it as mainstream media these days.
Finally getting it right.
alleging breaches of the Convention Against Genocide, and in addition, requesting that the case move forward on an expedited basis, and also that the court call on Israel to stop actions in Gaza that South Africa is alleging breach the Genocide Convention while the action is pending. So the specifics of the application allege that what Israel is currently doing in Gaza amounts to genocide because, and I quote, they are intended to bring about the destruction of a substantial part of the Palestinian national, racial, and ethnic group. And the acts in question include killing Palestinians in Gaza, causing them serious bodily and mental harm, and inflicting on them conditions of life calculated to bring about their physical destruction. There is a lot going on here in terms of what this means institutionally for the ICJ, what is going on with the jurisdictional issue. You know that this is a podcast for nerds because that was actually the first question that I wrote down. Let's start with the question of what the implications are, and then I do want to move to the merits before we get to the spicy, spicy jurisdictional questions. Natalie, what do you make of this? Is this likely to have any effect?
So I think that question sort of depends on the nature in which you are looking for impact, because as we know, the International Court of Justice is on the one hand quite powerful in the sense that it is widely respected. It is a place where states are brought in a manner that no other court can accomplish. On the other hand, it doesn't have any real enforcement powers. And so in a certain way, its judgments are sort of a statement of global foreign policy or approbation, or a way in which to come up with, in some cases, purely advisory opinions about what a dispute, how a dispute should be resolved. But again, it has no enforcement powers. So there are many, many occasions over the course of history where states who have a judgment against them don't really do what they are supposed to do according to the court's ruling. That said, I think that there is an impact by the fact of having the case and having the hearings. A lot of information will come out. Israel and South Africa are both forced to make their case, you know, not purely in the media or in statements before the General Assembly or something like that. They're forced to sort of construct around legal arguments what they are claiming. So it is a way to air this discussion with a structure that really can't be found elsewhere.
I think that's all right. And it's worth thinking about actually what this posture of this matter is procedurally and what's being asked for at this particular stage, because this is particular hearing that's going to happen this Thursday and Friday in The Hague, where the ICJ is located, centers on something called provisional measures. And that is kind of like the equivalent of what in US law we think of as a preliminary injunction usually, or certain other forms of kind of preliminary relief. The idea is to say, okay, there is a matter here, there is a dispute that is at least colorably within the court's jurisdiction. Interestingly, like that ties back to the jurisdictional question, which we'll get to in a minute, which is part of the more controversial aspect of this case, but it's really essential to that, to understanding why this is kind of a novel case to be brought. But essentially, they're saying, arguing, South Africa, that there is a serious chance that Israel is violating these obligations or the risk of it. And we're asking for certain measures to be implemented that will limit the risk of that getting further until we can litigate out exactly what Israel's obligations are in this regard. Notably, in other recent cases, in Gambia v. Myanmar, and in the Ukraine versus Russia, we've seen plaintiff states, and in Gambia, it was similar to here, a third party state, of using a similar jurisdictional theory, be able to argue and persuade the court essentially that matters ongoing, while they couldn't make a firm decision that this was in fact an act of genocide or otherwise violative of the Genocide Convention, that there was enough signs that something was happening in that direction that certain provisional measures were in fact warranted. And that seems, my guess is that's what actually like the most practical outcome of this is likely to be, certainly in the near term, which is some of the provisional measures being asked for are things like access to Israel for different types of investigatory missions by UN bodies. It also raises the issue as to whether or not why people who are making genocidal statements, there's, you know, in the press, we've seen members of the governing coalition even make pretty horrible statements about what should happen to the Palestinians that you could construe as genocidal in certain cases, or at least drifting in that direction. And the Genocide Convention says, in fact, you're supposed to be punishing those people who make those sorts of statements. That the United States, that raises First Amendment issues in some cases. You know, it's a question about how that actual obligation gets implemented domestically in different legal systems. But there's a compelling case to be made. Well, at least if nothing else, if it's a member of the governing coalition, you should be countermanding them, saying, no, this is not the public position, condemning them, taking other measures, even if maybe you can't legally punish them. Make clear it's not actually the policy. That's in Israel's legal interest now because they have to going to have to defend its conduct. And, you know, it's also potentially a provisional measure that might be imposed. The provisional measures can range all the way up to saying, hey, Israel, stop your military campaign. I doubt it will go that far for the simple reason that Israel's campaign here is rooted in self-defense. And self-defense is a right under the UN Charter that the UN institutions, of which ICJ is one, specifically says nothing the ICJ, UN institutions do, nothing in the UN Charter shall intrude upon the inherent right to self-defense. It's kind of a pre-existing international law right. So there's going to be some limits, I suspect, the court will see in how much it can direct Israel to not take actions that are genuinely in its self-interest. But might it be able to say things like, let's get humanitarian access to Gaza, bring in more assistance, end, you know, starvation and other measures that are being pursued in Gaza, or at least are the consequences of measure being pursued, if not the deliberate policy being advanced, they might say that. And then the question gets back to what Natalie's getting at, which is like, to what extent can this actually be enforced? And it's true, there's no direct enforcement mechanism, but these decisions can enter into the political calculus meaningfully for certain states, particularly European states, which do actually even see themselves as having an international legal obligation to enforce them to some extent in many cases. A lot of third-party states actually feel that way, not just Europe. I believe New Zealand tends to approach ICJ judgments that way, as do other countries, a number of other countries. And even where they don't see like an obligation to automatically enforce ICJ, like the United States certainly doesn't, because it doesn't agree with the ICJ in many cases, it is a talking point. It is a point that they can go to the Israelis or other people and say, look, we got to push back in this direction because you're getting the whole international community riled up against you and other states are going to be doing more draconian things. We need to take this seriously. So I actually think it could be a meaningful step around these provisional measures. Then there's the much bigger question of what is there actually going to be a finding of Israel having committed genocide? I'm much more dubious about that actually on the merits. But at this provisional measure stage, the bar is much lower. And I think you really could see some provisional measures come out of this that are substantive and meaningful, particularly if they're married with some sort of enforcement effort by member states.
So what do you both make of the claim by South Africa that Israel's actions in Gaza constitute a genocide? This is something that has been raised in, I think, more and less rigorous ways, sort of since the beginning of Israel's campaign in Gaza. But I think it's, you know, it's not worth brushing off entirely. It has been made by serious scholars, including by some serious Israeli scholars who have argued that if it isn't genocide, it is on the path there. Obviously, this is a pretty serious allegation, and I think that Israel seems to be taking it seriously, perhaps for that reason. So, Natalie, I'm curious for your read here.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is an area where the specificities of what constitutes a war crime versus a crime against humanity versus a violation of the Genocide Convention becomes actually quite important to the extent that this case as it is under the Genocide Convention. So the Genocide Convention, I think it's probably just worth our saying explicitly, what it forbids is, and I'll quote, intent to destroy in whole or in part a national, ethnic, racial, or religious group as such. So one of the things that's really, really important about the Genocide Convention is that the attempt has to be to destroy the group, not to destroy individuals who happen to all be part of the same group. So the intent aspect is the hardest thing to prove in a genocide case. There's one thing that, as I was preparing for this last night, I was reading analysis by an expert in the Holocaust and who is sort of a historian of various types of genocides. One thing that he explained that I was not familiar with before that I think is interesting is, so there's a separate crime, not really well defined specifically under any international convention, known as ethnic cleansing, which I think we've referenced a little bit. It's sort of generally under the heading of a crime against humanity. But what that means is it's about removing people from territory that you want. So genocide is destroying the group, no matter where it is. Ethnic cleansing is sort of getting rid of a group. And this scholar was talking about the sort of potentially slippery slope between ethnic cleansing and genocide in certain examples in history, where what began as ethnic cleansing, or what was properly construed as ethnic cleansing in the beginning, really became genocide by virtue of the way in which it was conducted. So some of the examples were like the Ottomans removed Armenians from their territory, but pushed them into the desert where it was all but certain that they would essentially all die. And then another example was what the Germans did, I think, in the early 20th century to the Herero people in Namibia, where they not only pushed people off of their land, but also pushed them into a desert and filled all of the water holes. So these were examples of something turning into genocide, even if the sort of framework, especially of intent, was a little bit harder to demonstrate up front. I do think that these are the arguments that will come up.
Yeah, I agree with all that. And I may be willing to put the line down a little hard on this. I think it's really unlikely Israel would be found actually guilty of particularly like acts of genocide themselves, bearing in mind that's not the only things in violation of the Genocide Convention. You know, the biggest barrier here is that like it's a very, very high mens rea threshold. It is your intent. What were you intending? You have to have this genocidal intent in proving it. You've got a handful of statements from members of the governing coalition that are highly problematic. Again, this is Israel's done this to itself by allowing these statements to hang out there without countermanding them. It's something that Bibi Netanyahu has kind of no doubt felt he's had to do for domestic political reasons, but it's a problem. And then, of course, you have like the fact that they've had a pretty brutal military campaign on a lot of fronts, and that there are, I think, much more stronger claims that they very well may have committed crimes against humanity or war crimes in different contexts. But genocide is a very, very specific type of unlawful action. The reason this is being brought as a genocide action, again, gets back to that jurisdictional hook issue. It's both basically, to get to it briefly before we talk about it at more length, it is to get at it, to get it to the ICJ, it had to be a genocide-related violation, a genocide convention violation, because that's the only way to get jurisdiction. There's no comparable convention that provides ICJ jurisdiction for those other crimes. And so it is a little bit of a dodge to pull it in. And it's a controversial one. I mean, it's understandable why Israel, a country founded in the legacy and the aftermath of the Holocaust, and very much as a response to the horrors of the Holocaust, which is the same genocide that drove the creation of the Genocide Convention, is now, you know, to be bring allegations against them for similar acts is pretty dramatic and understandably controversial. But I think in this case, it was seen as the only route to really access this international justice system. And while I am highly dubious that they will actually succeed at proving in the end a merits case, again, the bar for provisional measures is much lower as the ICJ has applied it for the last 10 years. Like the ICJ has been willing to say, we're going to direct provisional measures if there is a, you know, substantial risk or a reasonable basis for believing there may be violations of these relevant international legal obligations. They did it very recently in Ukraine and Russia in a way a lot of countries celebrated, right? We saw it, they're debating similar measures in Gambia v. Myanmar. And like these are, the ICJ is clearly confident and comfortable taking these sorts of steps. And the bar is just much lower there. And so it creates a strategic incentive to say, well, if we can build at least a colorable case that there's genocide here, even if we lose at the end, that's 3 or 4 years down the road. In between, we can get these provisional measures in place that may actually try and curb Israeli conduct or build political pressure to curb different types of Israeli actions that are most problematic because they could be read as an act of genocide or contributing to genocide in some way, but they probably are also contributing to war crimes or crimes against humanity or just generally military action that we're not comfortable with, even if it might be lawful. And therefore, this is built pressure against those and another avenue for that sort of campaign. But that doesn't mean they're going to win on the genocide in the end, but they also don't need to get what they want.
So let's talk about the jurisdictional issues.
Finally. It's finally coming up.
If you look
up
at a map, you may notice South Africa. It's not anywhere near Israel. Why are they able to bring this case in the first place?
So it all comes back to the pun that we had in our subject header, which I said ergo omnes, but really it's erga omnes is the concept. I said ergo.
That's the like quality ergo of the wordplay that you get. That's on the quality rational of
wordplay.
Security.
We're doing it in Latin now, which I do not know. So apologies if I messed that up. Erga, and it both has the idea of an erga omnes obligation. This is the idea that there are certain obligations in international law that are owed to the entire international community, and that the entire international community has a cognizable legal interest in seeing the compliance with by all other members of the international community, all other states. There's a handful of interest in this way, of legal interest that not all international legal violations, most are not erga omnes violations, but there's a whole handful that have kind of like states and practitioners and international legal scholars have kind of said, no, this is probably like so foundational and so widely subscribed to that it is an erga omnes obligation, and genocide is one of them. So is aggression, the prohibition against aggression, and a handful of other kind of violations, right? And so we saw a few years ago in the Gambia v. Myanmar case, a case where Gambia, a country, again, very far from Myanmar, not a lot to do with Myanmar, initiate action actually on behalf of a number of states that are part of the Organization of the Islamic Conference, which kind of initiated this particular litigation, suing Myanmar in the ICJ on the theory that they're committing genocide against the Rohingya population there, and that in doing so, they are violating erga omnes obligations, and that these countries, these OIC members, have an obligation, or at least the legal standing, to bring a claim before the ICJ. And then importantly, in alleging violation of the Genocide Convention is one of the few widely subscribed to international treaties that includes in it an ICJ jurisdiction provision. This was very common in the years right after World War II, but because states, and particularly the United States and a couple other powerful states, started finding themselves with greater friction with the ICJ throughout the 70s and onward, we saw most treaties exclude these provisions that were concluded later, or they would be concluded through separate protocols like the VCDR and VCCR, which the United States, for example, originally subscribed to and then withdrew from in subsequent years because they didn't want to subject disputes around those treaties to ICJ jurisdiction. Not many treaties are on the books actually have this automatic turn to the ICJ. The Genocide Convention is one of them. And that's why it's such an appealing avenue here, because if you can make your argument a genocide argument, then you can get to the ICJ. It's what Ukraine did with Russia. I mean, the only reason Ukraine was able to make those claims was because Russia premised its invasion of Ukraine in part on allegations of genocide against the Ukrainians. That was a real shoot yourself in the foot moment for Russia because it gave the ICJ jurisdiction. And it's a similar step happening here. The genocide argument is the basis for jurisdiction. But again, I'm not sure like the strategic goal of this litigation is to win in the end. It's to build a credible enough case to get provisional measures that might make a difference in the short to medium term. And it all boils down to jurisdiction. Like the Genocide Convention, these allegations of genocide are necessary to get ICJ jurisdiction to get those provisional measures. But if you get provisional measures that prevent violations of Genocide Convention, many of them will also prevent a variety of other unlawful or otherwise objectionable actions, at least in the eyes of the people bringing this litigation, and serve that instrumental purpose.
One thing that I was thinking about, and I'm curious what each of your takes is in these proceedings, other states can intervene, actually. And I started wondering if the U.S. would intervene. I mean, we generally, as Scott mentioned, don't particularly love the ICJ, but I was wondering in this instance, I don't know, what do you guys think?
I guess it's hard for me to see that that might happen just because this is such a political mess in the United States right now in terms of U.S. support for Israel. I mean, I think the Biden administration is, I don't know if they're still attempting the bear hug, embrace Israel in public, criticize them in private strategy, but there's certainly a lot of discontent within the Democratic Party over the matter. And so just as a political issue, it seems like weighing in the ICJ on either side, not that it would weigh in on South Africa's side, is kind of a loser, but I don't know.
Yeah, this question of intervention is really interesting. You know, the United States is in a little bit of a difficult position because I believe, I was just looking up to verify this, and I believe, if I'm recalling correctly, they actually argued in favor of jurisdiction in the Ukraine-Russia case, which is a very similar theory of jurisdiction here on the Genocide Convention front, meaning like there's credible allegations here. I don't recall their position on the erga omnes violation, but there are other contexts where Russia, where the United States has been willing to lean into erga omnes obligations recently, that might make it hard for them to run away from it openly. And so it's a little bit of a tricky wicket for them to kind of navigate. My strong suspicion is that they will file an intervention in support of Israel, essentially arguing that there is no evidence of genocide here. Now, that may be tricky to navigate. I think they will say, essentially, echo arguments that Israel is likely to make, that say, essentially, look, you have the, this is primarily relying upon statements by people who are not part of the war cabinet and do not direct Israeli policy in this area. There's lots of other things that Israel is doing. And it may require the kind of difficult concession that Israel likely is going to have to make, saying there's a very colorable case that these are violations of other aspects of international law, but just not genocide. And that genocide shouldn't be expanded to encompass these. The hardest part of that, actually, for Israel and the United States, will be the lesser genocide. I feel bad saying it that way, but like the non-genocide genocide convention violations, the failure to punish incitement to genocide in some cases, you know, the potentially conspiracy, the failure to investigate conspiracy to commit genocide in certain actions. And so there, you know, there are ways that the argument's going to be harder to make. But when it comes to the actual committing genocide, I think the United States will probably not have a trouble making that argument. But that might not be enough for the ICJ to then, again, say, well, there's enough scattered facts here that we will still take up provisional measures. Because, again, the bar is just much lower there.
Israel recently made, I think, really interesting choice in terms of how it wants to handle this case. So correct me if I'm wrong, both of you, but my understanding is that under the ICJ, if a state that has a case against it doesn't have a judge of its nationality on the bench, it can choose a judge sort of from its own pool to sit on the bench. And Israel selected Aharon Barak, who is a retired president of the Israeli Supreme Court, and is not only someone who I think it's fair to say the current government is not a fan of, he is the Israeli Supreme Court justice who kind of kickstarted a lot of the developments in the history of the Israeli Supreme Court that the Netanyahu government was attempting to really overthrow with the judicial reforms that have now been kind of nixed. So Barak's appointment has created a lot of discontent on the Israeli far right. But I think that the fact that the Netanyahu government chose him to represent Israel is a really interesting choice in a number of ways. Scott, I'm curious what you make of it.
It's a really interesting step, but I think is representative of just how seriously actually Israel is taking this action. Israel initially responded to this action with what has become like a very common rhetorical move, where they essentially say this is kind of a degree of bias on behalf of the international community. I think one of the official Israeli government spokespeople compared it to blood libel, South Africa's allegations, saying it was something akin to following in the kind of vein of the Holocaust, or otherwise siding with Holocaust deniers and people echoing similar violations there. This is not like a stronger version, but a similar rhetorical line that Israel often follows when it receives criticism or is the target of action in the international community. They allege bias on behalf of the international community. And I think we should be, if I'm being honest, I think there is something to that, in that the international community is very focused on Israel compared to historically certain other national contexts. I don't think that necessarily is a complete defense in all cases, or sufficient to say, well, then we need to disregard these other proceedings or these allegations. And a lot of it has to do with the relationship of the United States with Israel and Israel's role in the international community and a number of other factors. But regardless, like there is some element of merit to that argument, but I don't think it carries the day or is sufficient. Regardless, here they're doing something different. Like in other cases, well, after you've gotten that rhetorical move, that's it. Israel will then cease to participate in whatever international legal proceeding is involved. Remember, Israel's been on the wrong side of the ICJ before. There was a wall advisory opinion about the wall Israel was building along the edge of what it viewed as the line between West Bank and Israel, but there's some debate about that. That came to the ICJ. My recollection is that they really did not meaningfully participate in that and have not really recognized or done anything with that judgment in any meaningful way. You could have seen the same thing here. Instead, they appointed a very credible international legal team and have appointed an ad hoc judge in Ahron Barak, who is very clearly intended to signal credibility to the international community. Ahron Barak is a very well-known international guy. He has spent lots of time while he was in office and certainly since leaving office teaching at American and European law schools, visiting them as frequent speakers. I met him several times when I was in law school. He's kind of like a, you know, every foreign judge of prominence likes to say they're like, people like to say they're the, you know, Chief Justice Marshall of that country. And people say that about Ahron Barak, and it's probably slightly overstating it, but he is a notable jurist historically for Israel, even though he is often at loggerheads with this right-wing coalition. Why do you appoint someone like that? It's because you think they're going to back you and they're going to be seen as credible to the international community. So it's a real sign of just how sophisticated an international legal actor Israel is when it wants to be, that it's hired these lawyers and followed their advice, no doubt, in appointing these ad hoc judge. It's worth noting the judge's role is not to represent them in the proceedings. They are a judge just like the other members of the ICJ. It is simply that they are allowed to appoint an ad hoc judge in addition to the standing ICJ composition. So yeah, it's going to be interesting. I mean, Israel is actually going to engage on this one, and they're going to have a legal defense strategy. The hard part for them is going to be, it's going to require them to probably condemn some actions by members of the governing coalition and come out and say, yes, okay, these might be other sorts of violations, but in the end, we're not going to, in the end, this isn't genocide. And then when it comes to provisional measures, the real question is, if the provisional measure is something like let a team in to investigate these allegations, or investigate like very specific concrete incidents that are seen as something that could be genocide, it's hard to proclaim your independence and proclaim your innocence and then completely refuse to allow transparency around investigations there. Israel may come down to that front. And I think that's going to be a hard line for them to draw persuasively, even for the United States potentially, and certainly for European allies or European countries that have backed them at least so far on much of the military campaign in Gaza. So it's going to be a hard line for them to draw, but they're taking it seriously. And we will see a genuine international legal debate around all these issues with both sides well represented, which will be interesting. Well, speaking about important legal arguments with all sides well represented, let us turn our lens from the International Court of Justice to the Domestic Court of Justice, by which, of course, I mean the United States Supreme Court, which just in this past week, if I recall correctly, maybe a week and a half at this point, granted certiorari in the challenge by former President Trump, or the appeal by former President Trump to the Supreme Court of Colorado's determination late last year that he was ineligible to appear on the ballots in Colorado because he was ineligible to hold the office of president if elected under Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, a pretty earth-shattering decision that we've talked about a bit before on the podcast. But now we're seeing this new and presumably, although not necessarily, final phase where the Supreme Court will reach a determination on the merits of what Colorado has determined. And then that's going to set federal law, presumably, at least if they don't use certain procedural dodges, that will be applicable nationwide. But notably, that does not necessarily mean that it will resolve the actual underlying dispute about what happens with 2024 election ballots, interestingly. This is probably a really important step, but not actually the final step in this process. Quinta, let me turn to you on this. You know, how should we be thinking about this in this broader timeline for resolving this particular issue, preferably before the presidential election, preferably before at least next January 6th, 2025, when Congress is going to have to count electoral votes again, if they're allowed to do so. Hopefully they'll have one more luck this time around and determine who the new president is. Put us in this procedural moment. Like, what are we living in right now? And how does this fit in the kind of timeline of things we have to think about?
Yeah, this is a fun one. I have to say, shout out to one Haman Han, a Lawfare's associate editor, who identified the 14th Amendment disqualification issue as something that we should be keeping track of on our disqualification tracker, which you can find on the Lawfare website. I will say I did not anticipate that we would get here, frankly. And I'm kind of stunned that we've gotten to the point where this is an issue that's before the Supreme Court. Clearly, I think the court is kind of trying to deal with this quickly. So we are having oral arguments on February 8th. The briefing is due in by the end of January. That's moving quite speedily for the court. But that does mean, because of where we're situated in the primary schedule, that the court is going to be considering this while people are casting their votes in presidential primaries and weighing in caucuses, which I think just points to how deeply unsettled this whole issue is. There's an argument that's been made by election law scholars Rick Hassan and Ned Foley, which I think you were gesturing to, that this is kind of something that really needs to be addressed well before people actually head to the polls in November, simply because, first off, people just have a right to know whether or not the person that they're casting a vote for can actually hold the office. And second off, because as you note with your reference to January 6, 2025, if we haven't resolved the issue dispositively by then, we're going to end up in a very weird situation where Congress might arguably, under the 14th Amendment, have a duty or an obligation or at least the authority to kind of step in and say, you know, this person can actually hold the office. And I think that is a recipe, as Ned and Rick have pointed out, for a potential constitutional crisis. And I do mean that in those words, not in the kind of exaggerated way that people often refer to it. I will say, I certainly, having spent some time with the briefing and the scholarship on this issue, my position at this point is the Supreme Court should just say, damn the torpedoes, he's disqualified, and kind of let the chips fall where they may. I think that's the best reading of the law. The question of how that would play out is kind of a complicated one, and we can talk about that. But the long and the short of it is that unless the court sort of weighs in on the merits and says, no, he is not disqualified as a matter of the 14th Amendment, rather than on the many sort of procedural outs that I think they'll probably be tempted to take, this is not going away anytime soon. Like, we are now in a world where it is going to be a live issue whether or not one of the candidates for the presidency committed an insurrection and is barred from federal office.
So, Natalie, Quinta just mentioned this kind of slew of legal arguments and procedural outs the court has before us. Can you give us a little bit of a survey of, not comprehensive, because frankly, briefs are still coming in. More arguments may yet come forward, especially because we're seeing a number of creative amicus. And this is the sort of case where everybody and their mother is going to be an amicus in this particular case. So we're going to see a lot more coming. But give us a sense of the broad contours of the different arguments and outs that we have laid out before us to get a sense of the terrain of what the Supreme Court's probably going to be focused on, at least.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the question of this from a legal perspective is sort of a great example of why people hate lawyers. This is like, you know, in law school, you know, one of your first days, I think probably of torts, but I can't remember where this comes up stereotypically. There's the, okay, so let's tear apart a sign on a park that says no vehicles in the park after dark. What do we mean by dark? What do we mean by vehicles? Do vehicles have to have wheels? Does a scooter count as a vehicle? What about a children's bicycle? You know, it's the ways in which the 14th Amendment Section 3 arguments can be ripped apart is sort of stunning. So I think this is worth just referencing because so much of the coverage of what is going to be before the Supreme Court is being really grossly misunderstood as, hey, look, the Supreme Court is about to decide whether Trump committed insurrection and is therefore disqualified under the 14th Amendment. And that's, you know, maybe they will get there, but there are about a million and one reasons in which they don't have to get there, which I think, you know, we can talk about the procedural outs, but there are also questions in the legal analysis itself that I think it's just worth sort of mentioning. So one of the questions, and this one is going to be before the court so long as it takes the Colorado Republican Party's statement of what the questions presented are, is the president one of the officials that the 14th Amendment even applies to? Or can you say that the office of the president actually was never supposed to be covered by this provision of the Constitution? And then another one is Article 3 of the 14th Amendment self-executing, or does Congress need to have done something since the late 1800s to actually implement it in law in some fashion? And then there's the question of, you know, would denying a party the right to choose its candidate at the primary stage of an election violate that parties' rights under the First Amendment to association. And there are a ton of other arguments that really, as I said, are sort of so technical and so precise as to exactly what every word of the provision means and how it interacts with other laws, that there's a lot to be said, and the Supreme Court can try to deal with it as narrowly or as broadly as it wants. I think given the stakes here and given the polarization over the question, my guess is that the court will try to do its best to decide as narrowly as it can and not take the opportunity to answer all of these questions once and for all.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns. Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Well, and I think it's worth maybe clarifying what it is the Supreme Court is deciding technically, because I don't think it's actually as broad as a lot of people seem to be assuming. Like, correct me if I'm wrong on this, because I'm being too technical in what the court has before it, although it could reach a little wider if it wanted to, particularly how it reaches the opinion. But the question the court has before it, I think, is as a federal law matter, does Section 3 apply to a president in former President Trump's position, a candidate in former President Trump's position, meaning he is covered by Section 3's obligation, and the presidency as an office is covered by the offices that people can be disqualified from, right? That's the federal law question. And then there's this factual question that the Colorado trial court reached, which saying that Trump did, in fact, commit insurrection, meaning it triggered the prohibition that's installed by Section 3. That's a factual question. The Supreme Court doesn't do facts. The Supreme Court here is essentially reviewing whether the district court's conclusion on that effect and the Colorado Supreme Court's conclusion that the district court was well-founded in that effect, you know, didn't commit a clear error. It's on a fairly deferential standard. That's what it would be in a federal trial court. I think it's the same here, saying it would have to be clear error that they reach a contrary conclusion. But that actually doesn't necessarily translate into, as a matter of federal law, he is disqualified from the ballot in all 50 states. First, different states, the Section 3 of the 14th Amendment actually only covers eligibility to hold or to be president or to hold office, not to appear on the ballot or not. So, you know, as we've noted, there's like this issue of state law. States could choose to put ineligible people on their ballots if they want to, I think, as a matter of state law. And maybe some states do or will reach the conclusion that it's appropriate. And then you also have the issue of, even if states want to take them off the ballot, what is the right fact finder? Do they have to reach their own factual conclusion? And maybe the Supreme Court, you could even get to a point where the Supreme Court says, okay, there's no clear error in concluding that former President Trump did commit insurrection. But if an individual state procedure or state court concludes that he didn't conclude insurrection, is that a clear error? Maybe the facts they see as ambiguous enough that there's no clear error either way, if it's done in a kind of professional fashion, then you might actually still have disparate outcomes on the back end of this decision, even if it ultimately sides with the Colorado Supreme Court. So I don't think this is the end of the legal proceedings around this matter. We're going to see still weeks and months of potential proceedings at the state level around this. Although worth noting, a lot of these are already underway, and meaning it might not be, you know, take that long to resolve them when Supreme Court resolves the federal question behind it. Am I off base on this? Does this seem right to you all? I mean, it just strikes me this isn't actually the actual complete final step that people seem to be treating it as.
I think that's right. And I will say, continuing the media criticism theme of this show so far, that the press could do a better job. The press and opinion writers in particular could do a better job of explaining this. That's not true across the board, but there has been a lot of coverage saying, you know, Section 3 isn't a silver bullet, you know, that kind of thing. No one's saying that it is a silver bullet. If you actually look at how any of this works, it requires, as you say, it seems like it will require a significant amount of sort of state-by-state litigation because, and I'll point to the work here of Andy Craig, who's an election law scholar at Cato, who's been doing really, really good and helpful explanations on this, including in some writing at a publication called The Unpopulist, basically breaking out down the fact that because state ballot access laws are so complicated and localized, there just isn't a way to kind of deal with this, you know, once and for all. And so Craig has argued that, you know, even if you did get a Supreme Court ruling, saying on the merits, Trump is disqualified under the 14th Amendment, that might not actually really change the political landscape focused only on the counting of electoral votes, because you could end up with, you know, blue states disqualifying, red states not, purple states not. That's kind of an interesting hypothetical. Another counterpoint is, you know, what would happen, as you say, Scott, is you'd end up with some states disqualifying right out of the bat and then a bunch of litigation in other states. But I think that, you know, where I kind of come down is like, look, like it, yeah, it's going to be complicated. And I worry that the court might look at that and say, well, that's a reason not to do it. And the counterpoint to this, and I'm drawing here on the sort of originalist argument for disqualification from Will Bode and Michael Stokes Paulson, which if the court actually disqualifies Trump will have to be one of the most influential law review articles ever, is, you know, just because it's complicated isn't a reason not to do it if that's what the Constitution requires.
Yeah, I mean, I think actually, and tell me if you guys disagree, I think the only way that this could maybe be resolved once and for all would be if the Supreme Court says under the 14th Amendment, Trump is not disqualified, which would be a truly horrifying conclusion, especially because that question is not really before the court to consider the issue on the merits. But I believe that if they say as a matter of constitutional law, no, he's not disqualified, then there's nothing more to be done in terms of debating or litigating whether he should be removed from the ballot, because states can't impose additional requirements for eligibility for the president beyond what is already existent in the Constitution. I mean, the one thing that I do just want to say, because as I think we've demonstrated, these issues are so, so complicated, is we released a podcast that I would really commend to everyone, where we had a very detailed discussion of the 14th Amendment, Section 3, and talked through the complicated legal arguments. So I'd really recommend people who are interested in the nitty-gritty of this look at the Lawfare podcast on this issue. I also just want to say one of the participants in that conversation is one of our resident Section 3 experts, Roger Parloff, a colleague of ours, who identified, I was just checking the date, in June of 2022, that he was confident that it was extremely likely that at least one election official somewhere in the United States was going to find Trump disqualified under Section 3, and that it would be a complete and total disaster. So his comments in the podcast that we just did recently on this really can make you quite frightened about all of the many possibilities of how this might go and how they all might be quite scary. So that's cheerful.
So I think you're right about where this, the only way you can get final resolution of this, Natalie, with one exception, because I actually think the final resolution comes later in the process, but it has a spot that makes people really uncomfortable, which is that if you don't get all 50 states on board with the same outcome, which seems kind of unlikely, then it goes to Congress. Congress has to figure out how it can evaluate eligibility for office, particularly through the much more constrained procedures we have installed now in response to the 2020 fiasco by the Electoral Count Reform Act, meaning they have a much more constrained ability to do this, but nonetheless, they have to think about to what extent they can eligibility enters in. But I think the real point of resolution, honestly, is if former President Trump is still elected, and if he tries to assume office or does assume office on January 20th or 21st, the first point where I really see someone having legal standing to challenge his eligibility to hold office, which is what the Supreme Court is deciding on as a matter of federal law, is when he assumes office and does something. And then if it's some sort of enforcement action, some sort of policy action, there's lots of things the president does day to day where some plaintiff somewhere will have standing and can challenge his ability to actually hold office. And that's where the Supreme Court will have to intervene and decide it, including the factual determination of, like, has he committed insurrection through whatever, at that point, you know, it'll go through the trial court, it'll go through the appellate court, it'll go to the Supreme Court. I'm not sure you get a full final resolution until you get there, as scary as that is. But I think that's, like, where the Supreme Court is most squarely teed up to have to resolve this issue. Let me go to one last aspect of this that's really been coming up. In the kind of last week or two where we've seen the petition for cert and then the grant of cert, we have seen this like kind of tidal wave of opinions coming out of people all of a sudden having, mostly law professors, all of a sudden having very strongly held views about the propriety of Section 3 as applied to former President Trump, but who haven't really necessarily always voiced these views vocally, or at least in op-ed format in the New York Times previously and other outlets. But now we're seeing op-eds all over the place and lots of different outlets from lots of people saying, Supreme Court, you can't do this. Not necessarily even for legal reasons a lot of the time, usually not for legal reasons. Very few of these people are willing to fully sign on to a legal critique of the case, although they may allude to various reasons why, you know, they don't think ineligibility or disqualification is in play here. But essentially arguing that it's just too anti-democratic, and as a matter of kind of first democratic principles, the Supreme Court should find a way out of it. I think the more tortured, nuanced account of this may be Steve Vladeck's account, which I think we may have mentioned on the podcast before, where he talks about where he thinks the law probably does say he should be disqualified, but it's would be bad, and that the kind of broader political values of the Supreme Court suggest that they're going to try and find a way to avoid reaching that outcome, which I think is probably correct. And I've always thought is kind of correct around this issue, if we're going to go quote our statements from a few months ago about predicting things. Quinta and Natalie, like, I want to put this to you. What do you make of these arguments, like, that are now really prevalent? Like, frankly, the weight of academic commentary and opinion seems to be the Supreme Court should not disqualify former President Trump, law be damned. Quinta, I know you already have said you don't agree with that, but why are these arguments coming forth now, and what do they represent? I mean, like, it just strikes me as a weird moment we're living in to all of a sudden have a popular opinion flip so hard in this direction after the most vocal voices, frankly, for the last year have been people saying Trump is disqualified and we should be chasing this process.
Frankly, I think some of it is that you can always get readership for an op-ed that says something controversial and counterintuitive. On the substance, yeah, I think this is not just wrong, but silly. And here is why. If you look at the actual legislative record around the 14th Amendment, and here I'm drawing on some scholarship done by Mark Graber, who we've published on Lawfare on these issues, and who has a lot more research that you can find on SSRN. The 14th Amendment was explicitly intended as a matter of democratic self-protection. It's an early example of what is sometimes called defensive democracy or militant democracy, meaning sort of restrictions within a democracy to ensure that, for example, a democracy isn't voted out of existence by a sort of pure majoritarian rule. And what I mean by that is that the goal was to prevent people who had shown they could not be trusted in leading democracy forward from holding office again. And here I will point to a comment in 1866 on the floor of the Senate made by one excellently named Senator Waitman Willie, who said of the amendment, "It looks not to the past, but it has reference, as I understand it, wholly to the future. It is a measure of self-defense. It is designed to prevent a repetition of treason by these men," meaning former Confederates, "and being a permanent provision of the Constitution, it is intended to operate as a preventative of treason hereafter." The whole point of this provision is that you cannot trust certain people who have shown that they will break their oath to the Constitution and to the United States to hold office going forward. And we have already seen this after court hearing that took place yesterday on the immunity issue in the DC circuit. Trump went out there and told a bunch of reporters, if this criminal trial goes forward, there will be bedlam. That is a threat. He is making a threat against democracy. All of these arguments about, oh, it would be undemocratic to disqualify him, it is also a threat to democracy if he runs and is not disqualified. It is a threat to democracy if he wins and if he doesn't win, because we know exactly what he will do because he already did it. Like, this is just not a particularly hard question unless you take a very, very aggressive view of democracy as something that means only majority rule. And by the way, if you do take that view, then it's not really clear to me why you should accept the Electoral College either. So this whole thing just smacks to me of contrarianism, frankly.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. And I think there's a lot of intellectual dishonesty going on here, or just omission of serious thought in some of these public comments. I would also like to just take the opportunity to plug Lawfare and pat ourselves on the back yet again, because Lawfare published pieces less than 2 weeks after the insurrection evaluating whether Section 3 of the 14th Amendment would disqualify Trump. And I would just like to say that 3 years before it was cool, we were all over this.
Well, I will agree with all that. And I tend to agree with you, Quinta. Like, I think the law is actually fairly clear on this. But I think these op-eds are capturing a general zeitgeist that is very real of how the Supreme Court thinks about these things and thinks about their institutional role, the modern Supreme Court. And I do think they are going to be looking for an out of somewhere along these lines, despite the merits of the argument being relatively strong, certainly when you look back at historical purpose and intent of the people enacting this. I'm going to throw my plug out there, but we're talking about our legacies. Months ago, I said I think the easiest out for the Supreme Court is a bunch of 19th century statutes that Congress enacted removing disqualification. And I still think that's kind of the case. Nobody seems to agree with me.
The Fourth Circuit, in fact, explicitly disagrees with you. The Fourth Circuit has said that is not an accurate reading. So there you go.
The Fourth Circuit, look out. I still think that's the easiest. I still think that's the easiest out for the Supreme Court. If not that, it'll be the self-executing yada, yada, yada bit. But, you know, you interpret a statute, you don't even have to touch the 14th Amendment. I think that's going to look really appealing for the Supreme Court. But no one seems to agree with me on that. So I'll just throw that out there. I think Adam Unikowski on his very good Substack said that he agrees with that as being the easiest out for the Supreme Court. But we will see. That said, we got a lot more to talk about in this domain in the months to come. I don't think this is going to be a story. The story's not going to end even at the Supreme Court rule. So we'll have opportunities to revisit, no doubt.
So speaking of gaps in the chain of command, we had an interesting news event, which had you all been on the Lawfare Slack channel, you could have watched unfold in real time. So the news on this really trickled in. On January 5th, news broke that Secretary Austin, the Secretary of Defense, had been hospitalized at Walter Reed National Medical Center since Monday, so for 5 days. All we really knew at the time was that he was experiencing complications after an elective surgery, but he was doing well. And the Pentagon did not want to release more information, it said, on the grounds of patient privacy. Then the following day, we learned that actually we weren't the only ones who were just finding out about this, because the Pentagon had not informed the White House, meaning National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan, but also the president, about Austin's hospitalization for 3 days. Then they didn't tell Congress until Friday, 15 minutes before they released the public information about it. And there were a lot of DOD officials who only learned about it from the official statement that went out. Then we learned yesterday that the elective procedure that was referenced was treatment for prostate cancer, which was diagnosed in December. So, you know, predictably, there have been various calls for a response to this. People are taking it very seriously. There have been calls for investigations and briefings and even firing. The Pentagon Press Association issued a really strongly worded statement about how this was an outrage and Austin has no claims to privacy in this situation. And of course, all of this is going on. The Secretary of Defense is not available, is being hospitalized. And we can talk further about what was happening during some of that time, which includes the fact that the Deputy Secretary was informed some of the time, but apparently not all of the time, that she was assuming some of the Secretary's responsibilities as sort of acting Secretary, but was not informed why for at least part of the time. This is all going on while American destroyers are in the Red Sea shooting down Houthi drones, and American troops are being targeted in Syria and Iraq. So, you know, I think the very obvious question comes up, and I want to pose it to you, Quinta and Scott. How much does this matter? How outraged should we be or should we not be? Quinta, I'll start with you.
I'm going to be completely honest. I have not thought so much about being outraged over this because I mostly find this like weirdly refreshing as a scandal. It's something that could have happened under any presidency. It could have been a West Wing plot. It could have been a Veep plot. It has nothing to do with, you know, encroaching far-right authoritarianism. There's nothing Trumpy about it. It says a lot about the Defense Department, and I know that Scott has thoughts on that and the strangenesses of big organizations with big responsibilities. But mostly it's just like, it's kind of nice. I'm sort of grateful for the Pentagon for this bizarro little incident that totally did not need to happen and is completely unjustified. So that's kind of where I am in. I haven't gotten through that feeling of sort of warm enjoyment to actual substantive grappling with the issues presented beyond that, like, this is bad and clearly someone should have done something.
Scott, what do you think?
Yeah, I tend to agree. You know, I agree with that. I agree with the refreshing nature of the scandal. And I think scandal is like a little strong. I think this was clearly a lapse in judgment on the part of Secretary Austin and other people who may have been involved, although it's a little unclear, like, who knew about this. Like, his chief of staff was also sick and out of the office and out of touch during this period. Somebody was clearly communicating between him and the deputy secretary in some way that, like, some people knew what was happening, but not fully disclosing things, right? Like, so some people were clearly in the know. It's not clear how far it goes. All those people, this is a big lapse in judgment. You shouldn't hide things like this when you're in the senior position of authority. That's certainly true. There's a possibility it might have violated some federal laws that says you're supposed to disclose senior vacancies in senior offices, but like, there's no enforcement mechanism. It's just kind of one of these general administrative provisions. It doesn't matter, but you should try and abide by the law if you're an executive branch official and if you're the president. All that said, and there's like, you know, protocol and other practices. It's all bad. It's all bad. Not good. The idea that this was like a major national security risk, I think, is overstated. Not substanceless, but overstated. Like, it would be a problem if a crisis were to happen, you could not find the Secretary of Defense, or he was unconscious during surgery. This is true. This is also a perennial reality when your cabinet officials are constantly like overweight 70-year-old men, which is the case. Like, it's possible they will pass out, or like, you know, have a health crisis, or get in a car accident, or their phones will die, right? Like, all these things happen. There are procedures for dealing with them. It is a matter of delay. It would be inconvenient, would cause some confusion and additional stress. Even major international crises rarely happen at such a breakneck pace that those sorts of hiccups will make a big difference in the determination at the end. Where they do, decision making is necessarily devolved much more lower to the ground because they're the only people who can react fast enough. That's why you have things like unit self-defense, a principle that says, like, if somebody shoots at you, you shoot back and you don't have to ask for permission to do that. Essentially, there's a little more complicated than that, but that's the basics of it. So, you know, I think there's a lot of people trying to make a lot more fire out of this incident where, you know, it's a fair amount of smoke through the ratio to fire. Not that there's no fire. It's a problem. It's bad judgment. I will also say, on the other side of this, it's also like just very human and understanding. I mean, the man appears to be having prostate cancer. Like, that's scary and hard to deal with and a personal matter, and can deal with like treatments that could be really uncomfortable and maybe personally a little embarrassing, right? Like, I get this. I get the human side of it. And it's, you know, people who act so outraged and are so willing to slander people over stuff like this, even when I think they have some merit to their complaints, and I do in this case, you know, you can't lose sight of that human element on the empathy scale. And I empathize with Secretary Austin, even if I do ultimately think this was a big lapse in judgment.
So I agree. I very much agree with the human element of it. But I have to say, I find this a bigger deal than you guys do. I think that it is not only a lapse of judgment, I think there seems to have been not only just omissions, but sort of affirmative efforts to sort of hide what was going on. I mean, especially I was really disturbed by the fact that it seems that Deputy Secretary Hicks was not fully informed of what was going on. And you know, at one point she was on vacation in Puerto Rico at the time that all of this was going on. And at one point she had reportedly offered to return to Washington and was told that it wasn't necessary because Secretary Austin would be well enough to assume his duties the following day. And I believe in the timeline, if I remember correctly, he was not actually released from the hospital the following day. So, you know, what's the harm in saying he's in the hospital, we're pretty sure he's going to be fine tomorrow and can resume his duties. But sure, it probably wouldn't be a bad idea for you to return back to Washington to make it very clear who is in charge here in the event that anything goes wrong. You know, Scott, I think you're right that it's unlikely there would be the type of catastrophe that would require such rapid response that someone wouldn't be able to find someone who was eligible to act as acting secretary if Secretary Austin was unavailable. But it's not a good look. And it's not, you know, it's not a great idea for in the midst of a national security crisis to have some people dedicated to the task of trying to figure out where the secretary is and who is responsible if he can't be found. He's, you know, he's also sixth in line in the presidential line of succession. I think this is a big problem. I agree with you. I do understand the human element of it, but you know, he has a prominent public role. And when you take on these roles, unfortunately, you give up a lot of your rights to be a human being and to have your privacy respected. It's just the nature of the job. It's why, you know, I never want to be Secretary of Defense. But I think that it's really part of the responsibilities that you take on.
I think that's fair, just despite my flippancy at the beginning of this segment. I mean, what it makes me wonder about is I have seen some arguments that this merits a resignation from Austin. And whether or not that should happen is one question. But another question is just given the holdup on nominations in the Senate, whether the kind of intransigence of the Senate here is actually going to be a real problem that will keep him in his job. Because it seems unlikely to me that if he did resign, that the administration will be able to get a Senate-confirmed successor. Maybe that's not a problem, since we all know how flexible, for better or worse, the Federal Vacancies Reform Act is. But I do wonder whether that might be a factor in Austin holding on to his job.
It's definitely possible. Although, you know, I will say the defense, the Armed Services Committees, like now that they've broken the Tuberville hold, are moving things faster and have a historical record, particularly around secretaries of defense. They tend to be one of the first people confirmed for a new administration. They don't tend to hang out there that long. So it'd be a little bit of a broach of a norm that's, I think, still persists in kind of this more partisan era to really hold it up for a long time. Unlike, for example, like most State Department appointees that SFRC has been sitting on for a while now in a lot of different capacities, a number of State Department employees appointees. So, you know, I think they could get someone. I'm just not sure that this actually warrants that strong a response, if I'm being completely honest. I think it was a clear lapse in judgment. I think he needs to take responsibility for it. You know, if it were combined with other questions about his duty, it could be a straw that broke the camel's back. But I think most people have a pretty strong positive view of Austin as Secretary of Defense. I don't think we've seen a lot of these scandals or mishaps, despite being like a pretty tense moment for the Defense Department, certainly the last several months. So I don't know. I'm just not quite there yet. The one thing I will say is like this reflects, and Quinta alluded this to this, so I'll throw this out there. It's like this to me, my first thought when I heard about the story is like, man, this is such a DOD story because there is like one aspect of DOD institutional culture. And I say this as somebody who worked closely with Department of Defense. I love my colleagues at the Department of Defense. I think they're great. And this is a virtue in many environments, but folks at DOD, part of the institutional culture is very much a take your orders and run with them. And keep your eyes down and like focused on the task ahead without a lot of critical engagement, sometimes with the broader decisions and context in which they're being
Scott
made.
Scott is trying so hard to be nice.
Because I genuinely love the Department of Defense. The people who work there are wonderful. And this may be unfairly besmirching them because maybe everyone involved in this was like an outside political appointee. And so blaming Department of Defense institutional culture for this is misplaced. I totally accept that's a possibility. But like I could see this happening and I've heard and encountered similar things happening at a lower level at a unique level of the Department of Defense. And I do think it is like there's a resistance to questioning sometimes. It comes in with this, that this would have been a good moment for somebody, even a career person who's in this group conversation that actually knew what was happening, to say, hey guys, yes, maybe the Secretary of Defense gave this order, that's how we're understanding it, but maybe we should go back and say, do we really want to do this? Here are our concerns. Maybe that happened in this case. I don't know. Again, this is a little bit unfair for me to speculate in these cases, but the same thing that can make the Department of Defense so effective in so many different environments sometimes, I think, can lead to weird moments like this where you have a lot of lack of critical engagement around certain senior decisions. And that would have been a good moment to exercise a little critical judgment for not just the secretary, but for people around him as well. And some people may have professional consequences for that. And maybe that is appropriate, even if Austin himself doesn't lose his job. Maybe other people need to take a little bit of a hit for this, because it's not just a lapse of judgment on his part, it's other people as well.
Yeah. So I don't disagree that this doesn't warrant his firing or resignation. And, you know, there are remedies that can come out in terms of, I think already the Biden administration has, through the chief of staff, issued more explicit guidance to cabinet members, et cetera. But I just want to say one thing in response to your points, Scott. I think one of the things that's really damaging here is that, you know, Austin was already known as a person who really did put his head down and worked and was very well respected. I mean, he was confirmed as Secretary of Defense 93-2 on January 22nd, 2021. You know, that's stunning. He's very widely respected. I have no reason to think that shouldn't be the case. The problem when something like this happens is that people are going to start wondering if the fact that he is, you know, not out there as a partisan political hack in the public eye and is instead working very hard with his head down is something to be worried about. You know, I think you're inviting concerns that the lack of transparency or the lack of drama is because there are more things that are being hidden. And I think that that can be really damaging.
Well, unfortunately, that brings us to the end of our time together this week to hash through these important issues, but I think we'll have time to revisit a number of them, at least, in weeks to come. Until then, however, this would not be Rational Security if we did not leave you with some object lessons to ponder over in the days to come until we are back in your ears. Quinto, what do you have for us this week?
My object lesson is tunnels. I am tunnel-filled. Tunnels are all that I care about. There are two tunnel stories that I would like to share with you all. The first is the story of the woman on TikTok, who some of you may have heard of, who is building a tunnel under her house for ambiguous reasons. I have been following this saga since the summer with total fascination, wondering why she had not been shut down. And she has been shut down. She is not in a rural area, as I kind of assumed, but she is in Northern Virginia. In the quite built-up town of Herndon, Virginia. And she is no longer building her tunnel. There is some delightful reporting on this in the Washington Post, which we will link in the show notes. So that is the first tunnel story. The second tunnel story is the story of the tunnel under the Chabad headquarters in Crown Heights, Brooklyn, which I will just read the New York Times headline about this, which I think kind of captures it. And I quote, "Secret synagogue tunnel sets off altercation that leads to 9 arrests." As far as I can tell, this seems to have to do with a splintering within the Chabad movement. I confess I do not understand the specifics of the religious dispute that led to the construction of the tunnel, nor do I fully understand why the tunnel was built in the first place. The reporting is notably light on this, but I am so stoked for the inevitable 30,000 word long read about this in New York Magazine. Please give it to me. I cannot wait any longer. And because all good things come in threes, I assume this means that there will be more tunnel news to come shortly. I can only hope that it measures up to these previous two stories.
It's Scott. He's digging a tunnel under his house.
That's right. Honestly, the thing about these stories I find so amazing is that they thought they could do this without some sort of permit. It's insane. I'm trying to renovate my bathroom in a very minor way, and it's taking weeks to get me a permit for that. And if I were trying to build a tunnel under my house, I mean, good Lord. But who knows? Who knows? Well, for my object lesson, I am also going to go to Twitter or X for a story that I discovered there in one of these days' fairly rare occasions where I spent time flipping around the website, because it is the most 40-year-old dad story, something I will be imminently in the weeks to come. that I've ever encountered. When you turn, people may not realize this, that as you approach and turn 40 and you are a dad, you become obsessed with history, particularly usually Civil War or World War II history. World War I really gets short shrift in this for some reason. I don't understand why. But, or in some cases, Revolutionary War history. And somebody who calls himself the civil rights lawyer on Twitter is at John Bryan with a Y, Esquire, because he's a civil rights lawyer, I assume, and appears to do some pretty interesting work in that space, is just hit a gold mine in that he appears to have bought an old house somewhere in Virginia or West Virginia. I'm not clear exactly. It is absolutely gorgeous in an absolute spot up in the mountains, and has concluded with the help of a local historian who he adorably is touring. And this historian appears to be fairly elderly, and so he's touring in a wheelchair around this house as he did it. The historian had a theory that this house was actually the last remaining, or one of the last remaining, log-based Revolutionary War forts. And that they just took this fort and converted it into the house by putting plaster over it and making it look like an like kind of 19th century plantation house. And so this guy, God bless him, he ripped the walls down and tore them out and discovered that, in fact, there is a Revolutionary War fort underneath all of it. And so he has restored the interior of his home so it looks like this Revolutionary War fort. And he has found just a wealth of artifacts from this spot that apparently has been inhabited continuously since, you know, before the United States existed. He finds stuff from like the 1740s and 1730s in here. It is truly amazing. And the guy is quite the amateur historian. His thread, now that I've discovered, or his feed is like full of random other finds at West Virginia thrift stores and antique stores that he then traces down the history of. One was like this chair that keeps popping up in photos like Forrest Gump of famous people from the 19th century, which is just absolutely fascinating. I cannot get enough of it. It's great. This guy needs to have a show on the History Network or something. I'm rooting for you, John Bryan, civil rights lawyer. But until then, check out his Twitter thread. It is truly, truly phenomenal stuff. Strongly, strongly recommend. Natalie, what do you have for us today?
Well, as I was thinking through all of the issues for our first segment on the ICJ, I was reminded of how complicated all of this law is, and understand that it is poorly portrayed in the press, both because it can lend itself easily to sensationalism and because it is very complicated. I was reminded of a really excellent book that I would like to recommend to people, which is called East West Street. It's by Philippe Sands, and it is an eminently readable part memoir, part explanation of the evolution of the concepts of genocide and crimes against humanity in the law right around the Holocaust period. But the discussion all begins with Sands's investigation of his family's history going back to Lviv in modern day Ukraine. So it's a very interesting story. It's much more accessible than, you know, reading through a casebook that tries to explain to you the legal concepts of genocide and crimes against humanity, and how there's actually a really interesting tension between the two concepts, because there were concerns that coming up with a crime of genocide would impose on people a group identity that might detract from what should be an equal concern in the law about just mass killing of individuals, even if they're not part of a group. So in any case, I would really recommend that people who are interested in sort of understanding the law a little bit better, give that one a read. It's East West Street by Philippe Sands.
Well, folks, that brings us to the end of this week's episode. But Rational Security is, of course, a production of Lawfare. So be sure to visit us at lawfaremedia.org for our show page, for links to past episodes, for our written work and the written work of other Lawfare contributors, and for information on Lawfare's other phenomenal podcast series, including season 2 of The Aftermath, which premiered but days ago and will be coming to your podcatcher in the weeks to come. While you're at it, be sure to visit us on Twitter or X at RATL Security, and be sure to leave a rating or review wherever you might be listening. Also, sign up to become a material supporter of Lawfare on Patreon for an ad-free version of this podcast, among other special benefits. Visit lawfaremedia.org/support for more details. Our audio engineer and producer this week was Noam Osband of Goat Rodeo, and our music, as always, was performed by Sophia Yan. We are once again edited by the wonderful Jen Patcha Howell. On behalf of my co-host Quinta and our special guest Natalie Orpitt, I am Scott R. Anderson, and we will talk to you next week. Till then, goodbye.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen,
premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.